first time.
Tender is the night, lying by your side. Tender is the touch of someone that you love too much. Tender is the day the demons go away. Lord, I need to find someone who can heal my mind.
Come on, come on, come on.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today.
Come on, come on, come on, get through it. Come on, come on.
My guest this week is a multiple award-winning producer and musician who from an early age knew he had a creative calling but couldn't quite figure out what it was until he set foot in a recording studio. He's had top 10 hits, number one albums, remixed and produced global superstars, and helped shift over 200 million records. And he's still full of passion for the music and the processes behind making it. I'm pleased to say my guest on The First Time this week is William Orbit. And we opened, of course, with Tender, from Blur's career-defining 1999 album, 13, produced by William in what can only be described as trying circumstances for Blur, more of which later. So we talk about that, but we also talk about William's earliest musical loves and projects, the creation of his band Bass-O-Matic and their classic track Fascinating Rhythm. We talk about working with Madonna on her career-best album, Ray of Light, and also his new solo album, which is called The Painter. But I started off by asking William, as I do with all my guests, what were his first memories of music when he was young?
Memories are funny because they can be real memories or memories of memories that kind of like carve themselves into a kind of rut in your head. But it's definitely classical. That was all that was played.
Right.
And I think it was probably Vivaldi.
Right.
The Four Seasons.
Right.
which at the time nobody, it wasn't as if you heard it everywhere. And I thought it was especially for me. I just loved it, every note of it. I would go to sleep, you know, with it in my head, relishing it. I think that's the one.
Was this just around in the household then?
Yes, yes. I can't remember the orchestra or the conductor. I was too young to remember those kind of details. But it's a very good question, because when was it? I remember the first time I experienced bass. That was sometime later.
Go on.
Bass guitar. It was reggae. My dad had a hi-fi system. That's what you had in those days. Mm-hmm. I was born in the 50s, and I was, you know, becoming musically aware in the 60s. I wasn't any kind of musician. I didn't want to learn an instrument. My mother wanted us to learn piano and recorder. But the songs that we had to learn were so naff. Just put me off. Never in my life considered I would be doing music for a life or anything like that. But, yeah, my dad bought a hi-fi, and it had bass. You know, it was big, fat speakers. And I heard reggae. And it was like, what is that thing that's happening down there? What makes that noise? How does it work? And then I subsequently found out it was a special kind of guitar, you know, with four strings on it that were really fat. Didn't have one. But, I looked at the pictures and read sleeve notes and was entranced by bass. I fell in love with bass. But music for the first time was definitely classical. We'd go to concerts, the children's concerts at Festival Hall. My mother would take us to see the young person's orchestra type of concerts, which were like Peter and Wolf. And so it tends to go all around the orchestra. You know, it's a bit of everything. And I have a narrator. And I thought it was very exciting.
Yeah.
There's lovely noises that was coming out of everybody's variously shaped objects.
Sound more than song.
It was sound at first. It was sound. Yeah.
What was the first single that you owned then?
Well, I didn't have any money. Pocket money was not enough to cover even the singles. It really wasn't. I did a paper round as well, and it was tough. But you had to have a friend at school who had an older brother with a job
right.
and listen to their records. But I went out and bought Badge by Cream.
That's a pretty good starter.
Well, I was obsessed with them. I was only about 13 or 14, and when they broke up, it was like, you know how you get a bit histrionic when you're that age, everything matters, you know, like a footballer is transferred and it's the end of the world, and Cream were breaking up, and I just thought that everything's over.
Thinking about the times you drove in my car. Thinking that I might have drove you too far. And I'm thinking about the love that you laid on my table.
I went and bought this single, which was all right. Actually, I like it more than I did then, as it happens. It's got a great little guitar bit in the middle.
It has.
When I became a DJ, one of the things I loved is I saw this DJ and he picked up a record, a vinyl record, and wiped it on his trousers before he put it on the record player. And I just thought, that's so cool. Because I'd been brought up to revere vinyl and wipe it with a special boom. And my father was, you know, he was a teacher. He didn't have a lot of money. He'd blown everything on this hi-fi. And if you're going to use it, you had to use it strictly on his rules.
Yeah.
You had to clean it and do the static and all that. I sort of bought this record and he put it on and it started off and it was going, doot, doot, doot. And my dad said, it's quite good. Now, that for me was a major moment because I remember it because there was never any affirmation about pop music in the house. It was a kind of awkward subject. And my dad, maybe because my mum wasn't around, of course it was at the wrong speed. It was, he put it on a 33 because it's a 45 and he didn't ever play 45s, so he played out albums. And
of course.
It was like after a moment of glorying in this sound, it's like, it's meant to be faster. And then, you know, he left the room. He'd had enough.
What would be...
You said bought. I did barter.
Oh, okay, yeah, go on,
trade.
Go on.
I did trade.
Go on.
Trade them. I remember the Court of the Crimson King, I traded it for something. I was always trading at school, you know, lunch money and stationery and stuff. You had to, because, you know, it's 1/6 pocket money. Is it a real sort of like, I'm turning the radio off now because he's talking about old currency. But it was 1/6, a shilling and sixpence. That's 9p, I think. 7.5p a week. Well, inflation, obviously, you could get a lot more with that money, but an album was 15/6. That's 10 times pocket money.
So what was the album then? Because that's the different relationship to a single.
Very different.
Very different.
I bought Bookends by Simon and Garfunkel, which...
Nice record.
Listened to it over and over again.
It's a lovely record.
You weren't able to have easy access to other sort of genres of music at the time. I mean, there was commercial radio. There was only one station. And there was pirate radio. It was all pop. And some of it was hideous, you know, like chirpy, chirpy, cheap, cheap, and stuff like that. I hated it. I mean, I really loathed it. It made me ill.
So even at that age, you knew what you didn't like?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes, well, kids do. You know, we'd all watch the Top of the Pops and boo and cheer and stuff like that. But I bought this record, and I was aware of it because of... As I said, I was aware because, you know, I would make a point of hanging out at people's houses whose brothers had record collections and listening. And it was also a little like a club, you know, of sort of... That's something so important to establish your identity as a sort of, you know, what I sort of fool yourself into thinking you're unique in some way, you know. But I listened to it, and it... got me. He really did. I listened to it over and over and over again. Still can. Still can.
When did you first record music? Because I know that you had, like, a bit of an epiphany finding your uncle's tape recorder.
Yes, yes.
But, like, the idea of, like, well, quick. I can capture something.
Well, I didn't play anything until I was 14. I had a guitar that I blagged when I was 14. And so then, you know, as soon as you pick up an instrument and you're committed, you're a musician, right? I mean, you know, it's just a matter of state of mind and an instrument. And I wasn't a singer, so I wasn't musical in that sense, but I would record things off the radio and chop them up and things like that. So I knew that if you had two tape recorders, you could record from one to the other, you know.
Nice. What was the first gig you went to that made an impression?
I wanted to go and see Jethro Tull. My parents wouldn't let me.
Some would say your parents did you, did you a favour.
Sorry. I might have to walk back that whinge, actually, because... Yeah, I mean, apart from one song, what else is there for an hour and a half's worth of music to sustain interest? So, yeah. The next one I went to was to... This is really dating me, and it wasn't great, but it was What was that Hocus Pocus Dutch band?
Hocus Pocus by Focus.
Focus.
Hocus
Pocus by Focus.
That's a great song.
Well, that's who I went to see, just probably because it was everybody, all my mates were going. We went there and it was like the rainbow and it was like really dirty, you know, the floors were sloping and it was just like liquid running down. It was just, you know, what is this place? And it was sticky and it was loud and I didn't really like the music that much. It just seemed ever so histrionic. I didn't get it.
But yodeling.
I liked that I was at a gig and yodeling, yeah. It was so loud. It was so loud it hurt.
What was your first professional music job then? What was the first that actually paid money, either as a musician or as an engineer or as a producer or a T-boy in the studio? What was,
it was,
where did it start?
I left home when I was 16. I was working in the workforce, you know, I had a job, left school. And at 17, a cousin was a guitarist and he was really good. He was like a jazz guitarist. And the two of us would play acoustic. I was obsessive learning. You know, I would just practice and learn stuff by copying it, as everyone does, and making up some kind of thread of your own. But I loved the guitar. And we'd play in this, I think it might have been the Hope and Anchor. It was this pub on Upper Street. And we'd play at lunchtimes for about £2. You know, out of pity money. But it was money. It was actual coinage, which meant that you were a musician getting paid. Woo!
Yeah. What about one of the songs from your list? Where should we go now?
Well, it's an album, but it was this electronic outfit called Tonto's Expanding Headband. And I found out later that they were these two guys called Margaret Leff and Cecil, and they were like the synth gurus. They played all the synths on Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life.
So this is the first time you heard
electronic music.
Electronic music.
And I would, my way of listening was often to, when my dad was out, put the two speakers on the floor and I lay on the floor with my head in between them. And I obsessed on it. How does this noise, how does this sound get made? How does it get made? It was an epiphany, definitely a sonic epiphany. You know that thing some people have is dysphasia, when they mix up colours and sounds? Mm. And I do conflate images and sound in a nice way, and I definitely saw a lot of colours. Not in a dysphasic way, in an aesthetically pleasing way, but it was just this brand new palette of sounds and timing and beats and little moments and chips of sound. It was just... And there was one intro to one of the songs, and I'll try and recall the name, and I could just listen to it over and over again, over and over. When you're young, you have a capacity for repetition, of course. Mm. Oh, I know one. Okay. There were two records that drove my parents insane. And I had a 78 wind-up gramophone. They got a jumbo sale. You could get them for nothing.
Mm.
My brother and I would smash them up to get the bits out, get the cogs out and the coils, until we were banned by my mum because she said you could lose an eye because those springs have got a lot of torque in them. They come out and hit you in the face. But we used to break them up, and of course their commodity's quite rare now. But, and you get lots of those old 78s and jumble sales. And one was, I'm going to say about five or something, because Love and Marriage, Love and Marriage,
yeah.
Love and Marriage, go together like a horse. Bing Crosby, I think. Who, yeah. I still love his voice, actually. But I was obsessed with that. And the other one was Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade. No, it wasn't. It was his Capriccio Espanol, which... I've talked to parents about this. You know, their kids get hold of a track and we'll play it 50 times a day, drive everybody potty. And that mine was that. Kind of became a kind of comfort.
It's interesting you talk about falling in love with synths, because I was listening to Prepare to Energize, which is like one of your quite an early tune, 83, I think it was. And the sound of that track is the sound of people really enjoying the sound of synthesizers.
We had this studio at the time in 83. We kind of ran it commercially, and I had this engineer, as in like technical engineer, mostly more than audio engineer, who did, because we're always into experimenting with electronics. I mean, that's kind of, I always like that kind of thing. I said, can you make one using the noise that came out of the synths, the proprietary code that allowed them to speak to each other? I said, well, why don't we just record that and it comes back and it works that way? And he said, oh yeah, but you need a capacitor here and you need that and impedance and blah blah. And it's like, yeah, just do it. And his name's Lincoln Fong, and that's why it's called the Fong test, because it worked. In this little box, made it with like a soldering iron and stuff like that, and it made this box, and it's like, wow, this is great. And then Prepare to Energize was a test that just took off.
Prepare to Energize.
This is it, like, for someone that loves, yeah, that loves sequences, that loves electronic sound, that kind of mid-80s point, there managed to be so much soul in electronic music. And I think maybe some of that is the fact that the gear was, you know, it wasn't all locked down.
No.
Yeah, it was all, like,
synths would go out of tune.
You could take the back off something and mess with it.
Yeah. You could definitely tweak them. You could hot rod your synths up. You could pimp up your synth sound. I mean, there were all sorts of magazines for people to build their own synths. You know, I never was patient enough for that. I wanted to get cracking on the music. And it was monophonic, so all the sounds had to be recorded one at a time and then bounced together. So it's quite laborious.
Mm.
But it's such fun, such fun. And then there it was, this track, and it got played in a club. Rusty Egan. We used to go down to Camden Palace, which was like a New Romantics club. I wasn't a New Romantic at all, but I went there because, hey, go out with your mates and get drunk on things like coconut ones, you know, I can't remember what they're called, but the kind of drinks that would stick in my craw now. But, you know, he played it, he dropped it, and it was a thrill. It's like, wow, he played our track. Some people are actually dancing. It was a moment. I always tell him that whenever I see him. Well, he always brings it up.
What's another first from your list?
Well, I really always loved Leonard Bernstein. I always get into trouble for saying it wrong, but I just love the enthusiasm and the way he talked about music. And, you know, there was a TV show, and I liked the music as well. I mean, everybody loves West Side Story, but it was so complex and ambitious, but with that verve, you know, he set the benchmark. I mean, he was a conductor rather than a musician, but of course he was a musician, you know, exemplary. And he just had this way of communicating about music that made you just fall in love with it. And when you see him conducting, he's of the flailing arms school of conducting. You know, there are some that don't even, they just barely twitch. But I just loved his communication. It stuck with me. It's just a wonderful gift that he had and just affirmed my love of music.
Is there a specific piece we should play?
I like My House, composed by Leonard Bernstein. I should know if I'm going to
cite... I always say Bernstein.
I'm going to cite him as an influence. I should know, shouldn't I?
Build my house of wood. Build my house of love, and paint my house with trusting, and warm it with the warmth of your heart.
I always say Bernstein.
I actually texted a friend on the way. Is it Stein or Steve? I mean, it's like spelling Jimi Hendrix with a double M and a Y. It's unforgivable. Which, of course, leads me nicely on to my biggest influence, is Jimmy.
Why?
I just couldn't believe it. Just the license, the sheer abandon, the sexiness, the soul of it. I loved his voice. Everything about Jimi Hendrix has always been my most, you know, revered musician.
So much of your stuff exists in, not a mechanical sense, because that's the wrong word, there's a sheen to
it. I'm not Jimi Hendrix by any means. But I use the guitar loads. Use it as a synth. So sometimes people will comment on the synth sound and I'll say, well, it started off as a guitar and it got morphed. But I play a lot of guitar, but it never gets mentioned.
Right.
So you're an electronic guy. I went through a phase of not liking guitars. I almost walked out of a Tangerine Dream concert when they brought a guitar on. I was ever so disappointed.
Not in this.
No.
No.
But I loved the guitar, and this man just, it just came out like, and I love the fact all the other Don guitarists at the time, you know, all just gave up for the evening when they saw him. And he was obsessive, you know, I was talking with this guy I'm working with. We were working together on this kind of, like, project down the phone. And he said, I've just got to fry some eggs for my kids. I'm going to do it. And I, OK, we'll come back to it. You know, I've got to feed the kids. And so I'll do it at the same time. And there's a sound of fried eggs. And we're actually talking about noise at the time and hiss. And, of course, fried eggs is white noise, isn't it? You know, incarnate. And I said, James, you're working on music while you're frying eggs. You remind me of Jimi Hendrix, because it's a story that he used to literally walk around his apartment with a guitar always hanging around his neck, and his girlfriends would turn up and he would cook them breakfast and fry them up some eggs, but he was also playing his guitar at the same time. That's dedication.
That was, of course, Jimi Hendrix and his classic track Purple Haze. A huge, if surprising, influence on my guest on the first stand this week, William Orbit. More to come from William, including stories from the Blur and Madonna years, and a bit about his latest album, The Painter. That's all coming up after the Six Music News.
Six. Six Music. BBC Radio. Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. I'm Adam Porter. At least 43 people are reported to have drowned after a boat carrying migrants broke up off the coast of southern Italy. Around 80 people survived. Danny Aberhard reports.
The small, apparently overcrowded boat broke up just off the coast in heavy seas. Footage shows timber smashed into pieces washed up along the beach, along with parts of the hull. A group of survivors, thought to number about 80, made it to shore. Initial reports indicate they're from Iran, Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's still not clear how many people were on board the boat when it sank, nor where it had departed from.
The Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab has hinted that politicians in Northern Ireland could have a greater say on the rules governing trade under a new deal being negotiated with the EU. Mr. Raab said an agreement could make it easier for goods to travel from the British mainland to Northern Ireland and reduce the role of the European Court of Justice. But Marc Francois, the chairman of the Eurosceptic group of Tory MPs, the ERG, told Sky News that wasn't enough.
Just putting a couple of, intermediate phases in, but in a situation where you still end up with the European Court of Justice, is effectively sophistry. I mean, we're not stupid. What we want is a situation where EU law is expunged from Northern Ireland so it is treated on the same basis as England, Scotland and Wales.
Dominic Raab has also said he'll resign if an allegation of bullying is upheld against him. He faces 8 formal complaints made about his time as Justice Secretary, Foreign Secretary and Brexit Secretary. The union representing senior civil servants, the FDA, has called on the Health and Safety Executive to investigate claims of widespread bullying in Whitehall. The government says it doesn't tolerate such behaviour. Police Scotland say they found the body of a hill walker and his dog who went missing in Glencoe last weekend. Kyle Sandbrook, who was 33, failed to return home to West Yorkshire on Tuesday as planned. Officers say they don't believe his death is suspicious. Sport, and there are League Cup finals in both Scotland and England this afternoon. The Old Firm rivals Celtic and Rangers meet at Hampden Park at 3. Manchester United take on Newcastle United at Wembley at 4:30. The managers Erik ten Hag and Eddie Howe both say it's a big deal.
No, I was never the opportunity to have the experience to be in Wembley, only television. I'm looking forward. Big joy.
Yeah, it would mean everything to me. Of course it would. It would mean everything to me to make the Newcastle supporters happy, proud. And I'd love nothing more than to see them celebrating on Sunday night.
Thousands of people have paid their respects to Olivia Newton-John at a state memorial service in Melbourne, where she grew up. The singer and actress died last year from breast cancer, aged 73. That's 6 Music News. The next update's at 2:30.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the show where we ask an influential musician about the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. And you just heard Bassomatic and their 1990 Stone Cold dance floor filling track Fascinating Rhythm, one of the many projects by my guest today, producer, remixer and reassembler of synths, William Orbit. So Betamatic formed when William recruited vocalist Sharon Musgrave for a new project inspired by Acid House, and it led to that Tom 10 hit and their one and only album, Set the Controls for the Heart of the Bass. I asked William what he was influenced by at that time.
Well, I got into the DJ culture and beats and stuff like that. Just shortly before, I discovered Rare Groove, discovered rap, which came out of Los Angeles mostly. I had a friend over there. There was a radio station called K-Day, K-D-A-Y, and they played nothing nonstop, you know, early hip-hop, like Spoonie G and people like that. And the minute I heard rap, I was like, this is fantastic. I remember thinking, I've been very wrong with my predictions in the past. I remember Pro Tools saying to Trevor Horn, this will never catch on. It's like tossing a coin, but I did actually say, this is going to be massive, and I was correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've equally, you know, determined that something's going to be flop and it isn't. No, no, actually, I would correct that. When it comes to listening to tunes, I can tell a hit. I know straight away. Most people do. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a hit, right? Because they choose, don't they? People say, what will I buy today? What will I download today? What will I use my precious time listening today? What do I compel to listen to? And they make that call. And there's a kind of a broad consensus across the popular music. But when it came to rap, it just got me and I loved it. And I had these cassettes that this guy would make for me. And then, of course, I realised, oh, they're just getting records and smashing them together and it sounds all wobbly and cool and just loose. And at the same, in a way, the same thing as a Jimi Hendrix. It was just all over the place, beautifully out of tune, if you like. And ad hoc and intense, and I loved that. So breakbeats became an obsession, and I have friends who was a DJ that collected Rare Grooves, you know, which you had to rummage for them. You had to look very hard.
Digging the crates.
Dedicated. And that's, you know, started to... I got decks, got used to beat matching on my decks, and then at the same time pirate radio was happening, and I built a new studio. And so everything's in the right place to do Bass-O-Matic.
Because that tune still sounds good. Still
got a bit of thump to it, hasn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Was we did a video and we performed it live loads. We went on tour.
Yeah, so was that technically your first hit then?
Yeah, yeah. Apart from Rusty Egan playing the track. Yeah, it was absolutely the first. I mean, I had no idea about record labels at the time. I'm these days, this current record, I'm working hand in hand with the label and loving it. Mm. And I'm really enjoying the process. But I had no concept of it. And I remember being invited to a dinner with the label from Virgin and they were all very congratulatory. And I didn't have any reference point. I thought, well, this is what happens, and I guess you make a record. We got to number 9, and it stuck there for 3 weeks, I think, at number 9. It just hovered there. We went on Top of the Pops. It was where you got a good response when we played it live. We never teased the intro out. I always take a lot of people on stage with me, so it was jolly good fun. But I didn't follow it through. I did a second record, which I remember at the time being disappointed in it. It was very hard to promote it. It's much easier to promote a record when you think you've done a good job. So I let the ball drop a bit on that one, I think. Probably just as well.
Well, there is this in your career. There's the lefts and the rights.
It's a kind of long-tail blessing not to have been too swept up in any cultural wave.
Yeah.
You always run the risk of being identified with this, you know, flag you've nailed to the mast. Mm-hmm. And also you could find it hard to break free of it because your sort of synapses kind of set in their ways. And I'm interested in that, how people, they find it very difficult to progress.
Yeah. Talking about a left turn or a right turn, although this does relate to the stuff that you were brought up on, Pieces in a Modern Style, people just responded to that record, didn't they?
I'd wanted to do that for a long time. Well, no, actually, I wasn't. I was going to do a record of elevator music. I put it to Rob Dickens, and he sort of said, come with me, my boy. And he took me with his wife to see Arvo Pärt play one of his performances at somewhere. And Rob looked at me and said, wouldn't you rather do classical pieces? And it's like, yeah. You know, and then I told him, actually, I had a very deep immersion in classical music when I was younger as a listener anyway. It wasn't unfamiliar. And yes, I would. But how are you going to do that when you don't have your theory? It doesn't matter. You just do it the same way, you know. Just not quite as painstaking. No, we had MIDI by then. Work it out, range it beautifully, and enjoy it. Enjoy the process. And it's great because I didn't think it would sell, and I don't suppose it sold tons, but I do... There's one nice thing that people say. They say it calms their children. If the kids are getting fractious and they put it on, it calms them, and that is, like, pleased to be of service. You know? That's a lovely thing to hear from somebody, like, calm their kids down.
So then this sort of rise to become producer...
Mixing, remixing, came. Sing. It came out from owning a studio. So we've got a record deal with Miles Copeland. So around about, you know, Prepare to Energize, the demo of it, is what got the record deal. When Miles heard it, wanted to sign us up. He had tons of money at the time because he was managing the Police and the Go-Go's and he was flush and he gave us far too much money. We spent it on a recording studio. So we went, you know, gone from two-track cassettes to four-track to eight-track, and then we went, bought a 24-track for an enormous amount of money at the time. You could have bought a house with it. It was something like £35,000 in 1982. And of course, we could have bands to come in and work in the studio. And when Torch Song floundered, we went into terrible debts. I took the company over, I took ownership of it and paid everybody off, like everybody's mum that we'd borrowed money from and everything like that. It was a slog. And I had to rent the studio out as a commercial concern, but you could, you see, because it was a niche that wasn't filled. There was 24 tracks were very expensive. And here I was with a kind of budget 24-track in Little Venice in London. And all the local bands, like the record people, all the 4AD people, would book in time. And I ran a studio, you know, like did the VAT and all that stuff, you know, and learned how you do all that boring stuff. And in the night time, when there were no clients, I'd do my stuff. And so I learned how to work. I learned how to engineer because I had this guy I knew took me to where he was an engineer for this studio called Addis Ababa, which was owned by a guy called... Tony. He spent all his money on this studio and he didn't really use it a lot. He just had bands in, and this guy worked there. He said, come on down at night and I'll show you how it works. And he had a 16-track and he literally taught me how to work a 16-track. I was just like, wow, in this studio, this reggae studio. In at the time, Westbourne Grove, Wilson Park Road and Harrow Road was all about reggae. You know, you could walk along there from the station sort of to my squat and you'd walk past four or five reggae shops that would blast it out so loud that you'd walk past, and as you passed the open door, you would just almost like levitate with the bass coming out. And they shut them all. They all ended, unfortunately. You know, local councils don't take kindly to that kind of endeavour. But it was Reggae Central, and near to Portobello Road and all that, of course. So I learned. But then I started to do remixes. Remixes was a thing, and when you do remixes, you get in people's multitracks. Oh...
Right.
Listen, to this day it's exciting. You get somebody's session on Pro Tools or Ableton, and you say, that's how they did it. Yeah, interesting. You learn. And so thereby I became a producer, because when does it go from being remixing to producing? You know, it's a subtle shift.
Yeah.
So I was a producer.
A friend of mine who's done a lot of studio work talks about, like, the normal producer's career from the perspective of the music industry is like, who's what's his name? Get me what's his name. Give me someone that sounds like what's his name, but's cheaper, and then eventually, who's what's his name? And it goes like that. Because there was a point when you were, get me what's his name, you know, when you were so in demand.
If only I knew.
I'm just kind of interested in how that feels, that moment of like...
Here today, gone later.
You only see what your eyes want to see. How can life be what you want it to be? You're frozen when your heart's not open. You're so consumed with how much you get. You waste your time with hate and regret. You're broken when your heart's not open.
Well,
it must have been a remarkable time.
Well, of course it was, yeah. I mean, I do remember on tour with Madonna, we did this little TV tour. Her press agent forever, Liz Rosenberg, was there. She was on it. And I remember one night, we all came back from this TV show, and we were in her room for partying, and she said, William. And she's got on her big bed, spread out all the press. And Liz kind of looks at me with a piercing look and says, William, we do this all the time. We've been in music business a lot. We've seen a lot of success. What's happening now doesn't happen very much, and we feel like kids. And she was giggling away. This is fantastic. You know, this is what we live for, this kind of thing. It surprises us. It came out of left field. Enjoy it. Little did I know that I hadn't learned yet how to enjoy such a moment. That's come later. Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying this moment, even if it's not as illustrious as that one. I'm enjoying it immensely, but at the time I didn't really enjoy it as much. But yeah, I was the man. I remember going to this party in Italy in Donatella Versace's house. It was Milan. It was MTV Music Awards, and she'd wanted Blur to come.
Yeah.
And I'd just done the Blur album, so I knew all the guys by that time. I met her, and she said she really... And Madonna had said she really wants Blur to come. She's got a thing about her. Donatella's quite shy. You'd be surprised. He's quite shy, in my experience of her. She kind of nudged Madonna, do you think William would get Blur? And Madonna said she really wants you to bring Blur. It's like, yeah, I'll do my best. And I don't like blagging, but it's like, guys, it sounds like fun. And Damon was always like typical. It's like, yeah, I'll come, but he might not. And I remember going around to his flat with Alex. We got a plane to Italy, and he's just in his pyjamas, and he pretty much came in his pyjamas, and we're out there, and there's this party, and I turn up, and the first thing, she's there, and she's really pleased that they've come, so that's nice. And it's her mansion in Milan. It's got marble everywhere. It's got carabinieri outside. Well, there's a reason why there was a lot of security there, why she had guys with machine guns outside, because her brother had just been murdered. So she was very careful.
Okay, of course.
But we went in there, and she changed her dress about 9 times, and there was, like, leaves all over the floor, and all the stairs were manned by these Roman kind of gods, like young guys in sort of greased-up bodies and togas with spears all the way up the stairs. You know, it was like... This is like a Donatella Versace party. It was brilliant. And All Saints were there. And there's Damon Albarn. And he's, William, this is great. Glad you brought me out. I've got a spicy in one arm and a saintly on the other. And it's like, glad to be a service. It's great. But I left early. I didn't really want to... I don't know why I did, actually. I just wanted to walk around Milan. My head was exploding a bit. So I left early. And I came out. And there's all the carabinieri. There's this room full of soldiers with machine guns. And I come out on the street. And I got a car they've ordered for me. It's a bit late coming. And I come, it's all these people outside, all calling my name. It's like all these people on the street, hanging outside her house. You're William Orbit, you're William. I've never had such a thing. It's like, they've only heard of me because of this Madonna record, but they're all saying my name. And to this day, if I go to a Madonna gig, you know, and walk around and try to go to the bathroom, then somebody's going to come up. Now, look, it's reflected glory. You know, it's not like I'm getting any big ideas about fame at all. That's never going to happen, but it's quite nice.
It's over, you don't need to tell me. Hope you're with someone who makes you feel safe in your sleeping tonight. I won't kill myself trying to stay in your life. I got no distance left to run. When you see me, please turn your back and walk away. I don't want to see you, 'cause I know the dreams that you keep is where we meet. When you're coming down, think of me. I got no distance left to run.
You did work on 13, which is my favourite Blur record, and it's got No Distance Left to Run on it. It's got Caramel, which might be my favourite Blur song ever, I think. It's such an interesting record because it is, I mean, No Distance Left to Run. It seemed to be, from the outside, an enormously difficult time for the band.
It was one of the most emotionally charged records I ever made, genuinely so. You know, it was a roller coaster.
Why?
Well, there was breakups going on with members of the band. There was internal strife between members of the band. There was artistic strife. There was a degree of, you know, sort of emotional veering from side to side going on. You know, lots of things going on in the band, with me too. But I was, you know, I'm not, you know, didn't ever see myself as a fifth member of the band or anything like that. But it certainly was a tight unit. So there's all that. And Damon's quite, you know, he's a unique individual, the way he operates. And he leaves a trail of tears as well as a trail of laughs, you know. Not because he's horrible, he's not at all, but he's just so good and so determined to see things through. And I don't think he reads people. He's such a smart guy. All the guys in Blur are super smart, all of them. But I don't think Damon reads people, so he doesn't realise how things are panning out in his moment of brilliance. But then, on the other hand, he was extremely generous to Graham, was being very contrary to everything. I think I've said this before, but he wouldn't play. He would simply wouldn't play when the tape was rolling. He would just mess it up. He would play it perfectly. When it was just out of sheer perversity, you know, and he's a contrarian, and he would just, somehow it wasn't right. And it's like, oh, right, okay. I'll just run another tape recorder the whole time and then have his piece of perfectly executed guitar and just pop it into the track later.
But somehow from that, you wrangle what might be their best record at a time of...
Yeah, I discovered Pro Tools, so I was able to really do, like, right. Cut and paste. I thought they were going to, like, string me up for making, you know, killing off the Golden Goose, because they'd had this string of brilliant... I love Blur, and I loved them at the time. Sound like Sing, and so, and There's No Other Way. They're just exemplary pop songs, and the guitaring is just everything about them. I love it. And I just thought, oh, Stephen Street has been making these records with them, and I'm come along and made this jam. They're going to hate it. The band loved it. I mean, they were ready to break through. I've said this before, but they had their Exile on Main Street moment. They were ready for that, and they lived that. But I thought the fans would be disappointed, but it turned out people like it.
That's Colours Colliding from William Orbit's latest album, The Painter, with Polly Scattergood on vocals. Now, this is William's first album in over a decade, and his first since a long period of inactivity and a battle with drug abuse. So how does it feel to be releasing an album now?
I haven't felt like this since about 96. It's not hyperbole, I mean seriously. It's I'm enjoying it this time.
It's a great record.
That same excitement. You know, it's not pop, but I'm exulting in it.
The wheels are firmly on... these days, but there was a point when the wheels definitely flew off.
Yeah, all four at once.
Was there a point when you first thought, I'm in trouble here?
Yeah,
I think I need for my personal.
Yeah, no, I was in big trouble. It's the darkest thing ever. And I thought, you know, actually, I was disappointed in myself. I didn't like who I was. I thought, I mean, without naming any names, I've sort of broken away from some, you know, there's a sibling and there's some other people. And I don't kind of realise later in my life it's. I'm not saying anything about them intrinsically. I'm just saying I'm a lot happier without them in my life. And it's as simple as that. And it wasn't a great childhood, but it was like everything was my fault. You know, I was a bit one of the, you know, you see it, it's awful. And sort of all came to roost, really. And I just thought, I don't like who I am. And so if not, I can't follow my principles. And it was really dark. And I think I like who I am now. I mean, without being complacent, to work on it. But I'm enjoying myself. Isn't that terrible? To walk into a radio show and say, hey, everybody out there, I'm so enjoying myself. Just throw rocks at me for saying a thing like that. It's a time of firsts and lasts. These new experiences, it's really got tons of energy.
But that's good, right? What else are we here to do apart from, like, try and better ourselves?
Better ourselves.
Find some kind of personal...
purpose, be of service to others.
Other people, yeah, isn't that...
That's it.
Learn a bit more about the world, learn a bit more about ourselves.
Yes.
That's the point.
Yeah, I think that... I'll go with that. I'll totally go with that.
What's the last song that we should play?
Oh, I've got to mention Frank Zappa.
Why should we end on Frank Zappa, tell me?
Because he was so brilliant and funny and just the titles of these tracks, just his sheer confident nuttiness. I went to this concert. Look, it's the 70s. We were young. And this is radio. This is BBC Public Broadcasting. So I'm not going to say more than that. But if you imagine, the atmosphere is quite...
chill.
Yes. with a kind of green colour to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm sitting there listening. And this lady behind me starts to freak out. And she starts off... I can hear her chatting. And then she starts to sort of get a bit giggly. And then she laughter gets in more and more loud. And I can't turn around because I'm sort of frozen. I'd get very like that then when I was a kid. I'd swing from being really exuberant to being almost catatonic. And I went a bit catatonic. And I'm not turning around to see what's going on behind me. But she's freaking out and starts shrieking. And it gets really... And I eventually turn around. There's nobody there. It's surround sound. He's got it on the speaker at the back.
What's the track then?
I think your listeners would really enjoy Willie the Pimp. No, Peaches on Regalia.
Then that's what we should play.
Yes.
It's been lovely to speak to you.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks, man.
Conversation that went off on many tangents. Thank you very much to my guest on the first time this week, Mr. William Orbit. And William's latest album, The Painter, with guest stars including Beth Orton, Georgia and Laurie Mayer, is out now. That's the last show in our current run of The First Time, so head to BBC Sounds to catch up with previous guests from this month, Cosy Fanny Tutti, Barbara Marle and Errol Alkin. Maybe you'll even stumble across a surprise or two from our archive while you're there. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.